could be radically different, like almost like speaking a whole other language than the language of the state. And you see, it's that's like different types of dialects and even accents are an interesting way of kind of gauging the changing cultural landscape. Like to give a, this little offshoot, but it kind of relates back to what we're talking about. You know, so for to give a real example, I like to watch Antiques Roadshow. Maybe I mentioned this on the show before. Of course, I do. The Antiques Roadshow has been on for a long time, since like the 80s or something like that. Sometimes I like to watch the old episodes, like back from the vault or whatever. When you watch these old episodes, though, I noticed something really interesting, which was, you know, in this old world, you'd get these elderly people coming in, and they would have these crazy accents. Like, these old people coming in from, like, the backwoods of Alabama, or, like, the Badlands in Montana, or, like, you know, just out there, these much more isolated, these people who lived and grew in societies that were much smaller and closer, and that was reflected in the way that they spoke, right? Their language and their accent and all this kind of stuff. You don't see that anymore. You watch a modern episode, like, yeah, there will be general regional differences in an accent.
Yeah. But the same phenomena you're talking about.
But those, yeah, and those regional differences are much, they're all kind of sways of those same large, tree.
Yeah.
Rather than these crate where people would be getting on, and you wouldn't even be able to understand what they're saying.
Right.
Because they're talking like some sort of crazy pigeon English.
Yeah.
You know, and I think as much as that's like a small anecdote, that's reflective of the sort of changing social world and the changing political world where, you know, the village, the township, the local area doesn't really matter in the same sort of way. But also, too, which I think we've been kind of like waiting to get into with this paper on some level, it also is reflective of how people engage with media and how media affects their political decisions and how media affects people's self-understanding and identity and the way that they interact, both understand themselves and interact with other people, right? If I'm consuming, you know, like everybody kind of sounds like they're from the West Coast because that is a reflective of where a lot, like the kind of you know media vector point that then spreads out and everyone participates in, whether you're living in California or, you know, West Virginia or Florida or whatever it's going to be, right? So in that way it's the kind of the technology aspect is definitely something that I think Ignatius it's hard to kind of expect, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, right? I mean, it's hard to fault Ignatia for maybe not having listened to McLuhan or have anticipated him. But again, it takes a long time to kind of get
your Canadian. He should have known.
Yeah, he should have known. He was right there.
Yeah.
It is interesting, especially because of the way that I think mass media intersects really interestingly with the central concept that Ignatieff is talking about, which is needs, right? This idea that not only are needs something that we need, there's something that we choose, there's something historical, and there's something supported in language, right? I remember we were discussing Edward Bernays a couple episodes ago. For anyone who might not have heard it, or just as a reminder, I mean, Bernays is importing all kinds of psychoanalysis and begins to play into and understand the role of mass media as changing the way that essentially products are being sold. He's doing advertising, right? Now, the central idea, I guess if we had to give Bernays an idea, is that he changes advertising from advertising about needs to about wants, right? That before Bernays, you would try to sell someone a car because it has these good qualities or because it has like good mileage or whatever. But now with Bernays, you're trying to sell someone that a car is mobility and Americans love freedom, freedom of mobility. Exactly. You play into a fantasy. First of all, you construct the fantasy, right? You create the fantasy through advertising. You construct a new role because in modernity, there aren't really set rigid roles. So people have to adopt them. And where are they going to get them? Advertising, right? And then you sell them that product to fulfill their fantasy. It's interesting.
Oh, I was going to say, it's like, just, I'll try and find where he talks about it in the paper. But to the point of, you kind of say there's no set roles, Ignatieff kind of brings that up in the sense of, again, like, if you look at, like, an older society where you were sort of born a society of, we might call it sincerity, right? Like, where it's one that, it's one where you are born into a role and you sincerely live out that role. And even the idea, the idea of escaping that role or living something different is kind of, like, it just isn't really a thing. And then obviously we end up like, you know, the 19th century, the Romantic era, things become more authentic, right? It's about finding out how you really are, this vision of self-discovery. Well, now the age of authenticity, a lot of people say, is over. And I know some people have talked about something like profelicity, but I also think I really always like the word like fragmentation, where there is no more like just like it's, hey, like that I've figured out who I am, right? Like, it's just me. You're constantly in this process of self-discovery, of reinventing yourself and all this kind of stuff. And that is played on very heavily by the sort of powers that be that control the marketplace of ideas to continue for people to constantly be engaged and shifting in one kind or another, right? Like the obvious simplification there is, it's like, you know, you're always switching jobs, buying new stuff, moving, and right, this, it becomes this kind of economy of movement that the whole system is built on. And I think, like, furthermore, Ignatieff, like, we're kind of talking about the sort of marketplace of ideas, we're talking about, like, the sphere of social discourse. But again, that whole system has radically changed as well in ways that I don't think Ignatieff really expected, right? Like, I know, I think we've brought it up very briefly before, but, like, the, you know, concepts, like, more, okay, if we're trying to catch, if the language is trying to catch up right now, and we're going to take Ignatius, like, we're going to heed his call and try and get the language up to date. You know, I think some of the more modern terms would be things like, you know, obviously we've talked about things like capitalist realism before, but even more modern would be something like techno-feudalism, which I think we've briefly mentioned before. But basically the idea is that, like, we no longer live in an era of, like, a free marketplace, both economically, but also by extension, a free marketplace of ideas and social and public discourse. And instead, we all more or less rent space in online marketplaces that, while they themselves might not be a product, they are the space for products to be marketed. And they are also spaces in which the participants are kind of unknowingly enter a very engineered process of engagement, right? So, like, we think about, again, we often make the mistake of being like, okay, we're a citizen, it's a democracy, polis. To credit where credit's due, I presume the polis was a much more free and open space when it's like 600 dudes getting together in a big hall and being like, what are the issues? Stick your hands up if you want to vote. Do you have anything to say? You know,
It's predicated on some material conditions, but yes.
Yeah, it's predicated on material conditions, and those material conditions, although not always, like, it's kind of hard, what are we going to do, like, fill up BC Place with, like, all the citizens who want to participate and everybody puts their hand?
I'm talking about the private public. The private, yeah, has, you know, slavery and stuff.
Yeah. No, but I just mean, like, the polis is this kind of, in that way, it's this very idealized, but also for particular reasons, this very idealized practice of, you know, democratic engagement. But that now as we talked before, many other episodes, and I'm sure our audience is familiar with, like, we have talked many times about how places like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, even just online news websites and all this kind of stuff, right? These are not free spaces, right? Like, these spaces are very controlled and monitored and engineered, tailored to you and to specific, you know, groups that you associate with. Like, thinking again about, like, Bernays and how, like, it's okay, we're going to, people really want to be identify in certain ways, are always moving from group to group to group, and we'll make these groups accessible or understandable or discoverable or joinable through this online world. And we can kind of direct the traffic and put the you know, put our hands on the scales and all this kind of stuff. And it creates the illusion of a more free society.
Yeah, there are certain it's kind of thinking about Bernays specifically, there's certain fantasies that are permitted, but certain fantasies are not. You have certain things that can be marketed to you. You can, there are permissible ways to exist in these platforms, but if you have the wrong fantasies, or if you cross some kind of line, then you're not permitted to exist in this space. Importantly, because you're doing the same thing as the algorithms and the advertising, which is constructing that space itself, right? Kind of structuring what is and isn't possible in that space. I don't think he anticipates the internet, essentially, because the one of the cruxes that he sees is the way that the welfare state is going to contain an inherent contradiction, which is this idea of the, because for Ignatieff, in a welfare state, ideally, there are no have-nots, right? There are only haves, but
there's just some people that have more, basically.
Well, the difference is that, again, going back to this central distinction of the public and the private, there are the haves, and then there are the have what they want. So there's the have what they have, and then there's the get what they want, right? And a class distinction opens up where you have people who are getting by, who have affordable housing, who get the food that they need, but then there are the people who get the cars that they want, who get the big jobs that they want, who have the houses that they want, who have all the, you know, the treats that they want. And this really does, if what Bernays is doing by creating and cultivating desires in a marketplace, the pain of being dependent on the welfare state is not getting to satisfy your, essentially your fantasies or your desires. You only get to satisfy your needs, right? Which is interesting because Ignatieff does, he doesn't set needs at, again, the bare necessities. He is willing to consider things like religious consolation as a need, right? It's not entirely off the table for someone like Ignatieff that something like a market-produced desire might be negotiated into a need that needs to be satisfied by the welfare state, I find. That seems to be one... If that's what Ignatieff is doing, he has not sort of seen what the market is, or he's not seen the logic of how desire is produced in a market according to practices like advertising.
Well, I think he's let me read another section from this, kind of prescient to this part of the discussion. He says, he said near the end, yet modernity and instability are inseparable. And then just a little bit earlier, he says, we think of belonging as permanence, yet all our homes are transient. Who still lives in the house of their childhood? Who still lives in the neighborhood where they grew up? Home is where we have to leave in order to grow up, to become ourselves. We think of belonging as rootedness in a small, familiar place, yet home for most of us is the conclusive arteries of a great city. Our belonging is no longer something fixed, known, and familiar, but to an electric and heartless creature eternally in motion. I think he was probably more prescient. He was updating, you know, the language of discourse more than he realized there, you know, by saying modernity and instability are inseparable, where there's this constant flux and change. What obviously missed and is hard to predict is how that flux and change is effectively at least partially sort of contained and controlled, like recognized by, you know, created and then capitalized on by the system that, you know, creates it, basically, right? But I do think that, like, yeah, it's obvious that it's hard for, you know, to blame him, that it's kind of like, you know, they can't expect the internet and all this kind of stuff. But there is one thing that I wanted, like, you know, he is clearly writing in a kind of liberal, neoliberal tradition, especially within the concept of person. This is a little bit of a step away, but near the end, he sort of defines being a human being, which it is frankly a definition that I just disagree with, and maybe we'll get into that in a moment. He says right at the end, there's 2 points. He says, we need words to keep us human, sure. But then he says, being human is an accomplishment like playing an instrument. It takes practice. The keys must be mastered. The old scores must be committed to memory. It is a skill that we can forget. And then further on, you know, right near the end, he says, being human is a second nature which history taught us, and which terror and deprivation can batter us into forgetting. This is a, like, idea that I've seen before, which is kind of a, you know, I think I'm not going to get any, like, particular quotes and stuff here, but it makes me think a lot of, like, Nietzsche and him being very critical of even the Stoics and people like that, where it's, like, there's a projection of, like, what I expect nature to be like, or what I expect, like, in this case, what a human being is, that fits my kind of larger political outlook. It kind of works like a little bit of a bedrock, like, and it's like, look, I understand you might say that this is maybe the best way of being a person or whatever it might be. Obviously, people living in very different societies where people act in ways that we might even find that Ignatius or ourselves might find abhorrent or whatever, those are still people, right? To sort of bracket them out and say, well, if you're not living a certain way, if you're not practicing being like a citizen or a practitioner of the political realm, that somehow you're like not a human being. And I don't mean that in any kind of like discriminatory sense, really. I mean that more, and it's like, I think it's a like naive and highly idealized perspective on human nature that you see a lot come up in, like, especially this kind of like liberal political canon.
I'll give you a Nietzsche quote concerning this idealized concept of man. Nietzsche says that man does not progress. He does not even exist.
Yeah. Which, yeah, totally. For sure, right?
Yeah.
To think that there's like this one type of human being. And it's uncomfortable. I think the reason that people, especially in this vein like Ignatius, and this is hardly a knockdown criticism, but I do, it's kind of implicit in a lot of this kind of literature. It's like, this is what it means to be a person. It's like, look, if you want to say this is what it means to be a citizen or a practicing political individual or whatever it's going to be, or free individual, even if you want to, or authentic, like, that's fine. But to say that just human being generally, there's all sorts of modes of being that are actual possibilities that can and have been lived out that are very inauthentic or very socially not involved or only basically involved, or options that are highly immoral, we might call them evil, and to sort of extract those kinds of ways of being out of the wider definition of humanity to make it more like clean, basically, is not something that I agree with.
I think that this can perhaps be recovered if we consider that when you learn something, you can make mistakes, right? Now, I think that what you're going for is not so much, okay, well, this excludes, like, literally people who are immoral or something are not human. I know that that's not what you're saying, but what you're saying is that this conception can be put so as to exclude some people from humanity and gives us kind of like a twisted idea of what it means to be a person.
I think on some levels, it's a product of looking at human beings in a historical light, right? We have this tendency to see this kind of like, you know, almost kind of like pseudo Hegelian progression and dialectic where like the human being is this growing thing and now it's developed and now like, and now human being is, you know, the liberal participator in modern society, right?
Yeah, like a historicist progressivist kind of idea of humanity.
That is how some people live. That is how many people live. But it's not a necessity for being a human being. And I think that's kind of the, like, is things can and probably will at some point be very different. And that's the uncomfortable truth of also, like, in some sense, this historical vision, which is like, you know, I think the mistake that I think the idealized aspect of that historical vision that people make is that where I disagree with is that it's always progressing in the right direction, right? Like, it's always going somewhere, like, you know, there's bumps and bruises along the way, but generally speaking, it's moving in a good way. I don't know if there's really a reason to think that that's actually the case, or to think that while that may be the case, kind of generally, things can radically shift. Like, things can change very quickly, and they could change potentially, like, it's happened many times, you know, to get off track. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that there's an interesting kind of, because we've seen Ignatieff lay out the next step for himself in a way, which I guess is like also kind of historicist, but maybe we're just historical beings. But the way that Ignatieff says that, you know, there's change and then you arrive at something. And then we said, okay, well, now we've arrived at a point where it's just change. There's like no fixity. There's no product of any of this change. I think that maybe something can be said for that in terms of this as well, that Ignatieff sees that we can come to, maybe he doesn't think that we can get better, or because I think that he thinks we can get worse as well. I think that we can change and we can arrive at some point if we're looking at how things have gone. We're just now at a point where it's not really that there's like any human product. You know, we don't reach, like, this is kind of how I feel, not to go into my own like tangent as well, but this is how I kind of feel about generational discourse, where it's like, oh, Gen Z, Gen X, Gen Alpha. It's like, okay, well, that's just like a frozen point of people that are born. Like, and like generally they show socioeconomic trends and stuff like that, but that's like a particular lens that you put on to look at things. That's a product of conceiving of it in this way.
It's hugely distortive, especially when that it goes from like, okay, we're looking at very particular kind of like general statistical trends or whatever, or kind of pop culture, you know, reflections or whatever it's going to be, to actually looking at an individual that would sit within that age group. And like the idea that you could use that lens to accurately predict things about them, maybe, but like also very likely not,
like, so certainly not about the individual, but
yeah, exactly. Like it's like very distorting. There's no end product within the context of the, you know, the sort of modern identity creating model, and you know, through the kind of, you know, social and political setup. Obviously obviously to me, the product is in the system is you. But you is not the point within the product, is that you is not a fixed point, right? Like if you is a constantly bouncing around, moving, changing, and developing entity or participant in this, then that's how the system, you know, that kind of participative system works.
Yeah, I finished writing an essay on Nagarjuna a bit ago. Maybe we should do some Buddhist metaphysics.
Oh, I know there's ways in which that actually makes more sense within the context of like the, you know, identity and today.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's like, but like stripping all like the good stuff out of it.
Well, it's interesting. Maybe we'll save that for another show where we talk about identity from a Buddhist perspective, leaping in from, you know, Canadian liberalism.
So social media and the Buddha.
Yes. Neti. The interesting thing that I wanted to bring up was this idea that the changing of this language is reflected in the arts and not in the politicians, interestingly, or...
No, those people are always behind the curve, substantially.
Yeah.
Right?
Always, yeah. That's why Ignatieff was one step behind.
Yeah.
Which, right. Interesting. He's actually... That is interesting, because Ignatieff is a politician, but he's also an author, so maybe he's got his foot in both ponds.
Well, it's kind of obvious, but it's the weird thing, and language is a perfect example of that. The moment something reaches something like national politics or even major politics, it's taken a long time to get there, but it's certainly moved through the channels. The only reason, you know, the White House is pumping out memes is because everybody's kind of done with memes. Well, people aren't like, you know, it's not like people are actually done with memes, but it's like, you know, it's not this kind of like special thing anymore. You can't be the man and be cool at the same time. It just doesn't work that way. With these sorts of papers of Ignatieff, there's always this kind of, there's a certain a degree of nostalgia for like the citizenry and for classic political participation in democracy and stuff like that. There's also like more and more, there's this kind of like lamenting that is dying out or has died or died a long time ago. Individuals writing even back then to modern times, a lot of people we've looked at, are right to sound the alarm with the fact that perhaps like losing that structure, as much as it seems, you know, language oftentimes comes back around. Like culture, obviously there's like a cycle, right? Or it cycles to quote George Lucas, it's like poetry, it rhymes. I am hopeful that one day this concept of citizenry, this concept of sincerity within our political and social participation becomes frankly cool again. Who talked specifically in back in the 90s about how culture and cultural discourse was becoming more and more ironic and satirical, and that eventually he hoped that there would be a new kind of sincerity where it might be a bit hokey, that people began to take more seriously again their political and social roles as something that's actually important to them. I'm not saying that nobody lives like that, but it would certainly seem that there are many other distractions impedimenting someone living out and feeling like a citizen in the modern age.
As much as Ignatieff is kind of trying to warn us against nostalgia and the way that this estrangement from modernity relates to our needs and whatnot, it's realistic. It's something worth aiming for. And the infrastructure, the political infrastructure, is already kind of there. We just need to dust it off. Yeah, so we've been discussing the concluding essay of The Needs of Strangers by Michael Ignatieff. Thank you for listening. This has been the Canadian Philosophy Show, and we'll see you next time.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Hello, loyal listeners. I'm Connor, host of Bitcouver FM, Tuesday, 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. And we wouldn't be where we are today without you tuning in and interacting with us as an audience. And so, from the internet, from the virtual plaza, thank you.
Speak up. You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning.